Want to find a way to give back this holiday season, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good, something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Tis the season for giving back, and giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Hello and welcome to the Back to Movement podcast. I'm your host, Bernadette, and I am incredibly excited about today's episode because we are diving into one of my favorite topics, busting back pain myths. And to help us do that, I am joined by a fantastic guest, Ben Cormack, a musculoskeletal therapist from the UK. And together we are going to tackle some of the biggest misconceptions about back pain. Ben, thank you so much for accepting my invitation to the show.
Yeah, my pleasure. And I actually talk, when I talk about back pain, I often say the biggest problem in back pain is often the misinformation and the misconceptions.
Exactly. And that's why we are here. So let's get started. Now, before we dive in, Ben, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey, you know, in the field?
Yeah. So, look, I've been doing this about 25 years. I originally studied something called sports therapy in the UK, which is similar to physio. My journey has been through the biomechanical realms. It's been through the world of pain science and neurology and motor control and every kind of level and stage of information you can think of. I've been there and kind of, you know, been through those processes over the years.
Perfect. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And do you actually see patients with low back pain? Or do you see clients with low back pain?
Yeah, so I actually saw someone with a knee pain this week, actually, just to mix it up a little bit. But I would say, yeah, probably about 80% of what I see is chronic back pain. I tend to get people from all over the world reach out to me to kind of try and help them with that. Sometimes I like to think I'm successful and then sometimes it's very, very challenging, isn't it? So we know that back pain is a pretty challenging problem.
Yes. And
I think that we know a hell of a lot about back pain. So we know what the risk factors are. We know what the potential causes are. We know that certain things are associated, other things are not so associated. But the problem with back pain, it's not that we don't know a lot. It's that sometimes the things that we really want the answers for, we can't always find.
Exactly.
I think
that's
the challenge. So actually, we know, in fact, lower back pain is probably the most studied problem musculoskeletally in the world ever.
Yes.
Millions and millions of dollars have been spent on researching back pain.
And we all know why, because it's one of the biggest problems, right?
Well, in your life, 80% of people in their lifetime will get back pain. I think if you were to take, you know, today as a point prevalence, somewhere between 10 and 20% of people might be experiencing some element of back pain. So it is also the most prevalent problem in the world. And I think that's where it probably differs from a lot of other conditions, is that it has this really, really high prevalence across population. So whether you're young, whether you're old, whether you're fit, whether you're active, inactive, etc., being human seems to be the biggest risk factor.
Exactly. So is there a common thread or pattern among the people you see with chronic back pain?
They are all human. That's probably the first
really?
Thread.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So there we go.
Yes.
But I think that the group that we have, if you say you took, you know, we do see a certain age range somewhere between 30 and 55, where it tends to be a little bit more prevalent, I think. Mm-hmm. I would say the spread of men and women tends to be reasonably even, whereas some other conditions tend to be quite female dominated or male dominated. So I do think that it is, you know, a pretty ubiquitous issue, you know, across the entire population. Interestingly, as you get a little bit older, over 55, it seems like sometimes the impact of lower back pain actually diminishes. So we still get back pain, but it seems to have a little bit less impact on things like quality of life, which is fascinating, actually.
Yeah, it's very interesting because actually most of my clients are above 50, 55, you know, so maybe, I don't know, maybe in the UK is different or I don't know, or yeah. I'm just experiencing that, you know, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, that's separating a little bit the idea of pain versus the effect on life. So things like disability as well.
I see.
So,
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
the prevalence of pain doesn't reduce. It's quite linear, actually, I think, as as time goes on. But it seems to affect us most in between about 40 and 55. And that's probably because life is busy and difficult.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. You know, I mean, you're very active between 40s, you know, 50s, even in the beginning of your 50s. But as you probably age, you are less active, I think.
Potentially, you've got less stress. Maybe you don't have to worry about your kids so much and going, you know, maybe you've... work stress has dropped away a little bit. Career isn't quite as manic and, you know, so there might be a few different reasons for that.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I didn't even think about that. Wonderful, yeah. And how do you approach understanding, you know, the contributing factors of chronic low back pain for each patient? Do you educate them or?
Yeah, I think we are seeing a lot of data that comes out about contributing factors. In fact, there was a recent paper a few days ago that talked about some of the factors that were involved in not just back pain, but severe pain in general, and how some of those things increase the risk of experiencing pain. Now, here we get into some of the problems in that contributing factors are not always causative factors. And that's the challenge that we face. So if we look at a lot of the epidemiological or the observational research that we have that looks at the risk of back pain, we see things like inactivity, smoking, you know, diet, all of these other things that are involved. Some psychological stuff like catastrophizing and these type of things, which are fascinating. But what's also fascinating is just because something's a risk factor doesn't always make it a cause. And that's some of the problems that we see taking evidence-based practice.
Want to find a way to give back this holiday season, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good, something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. 'Tis the season for giving back, and giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. G-O-F-U-N-D-M-E FUNDME.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Bringing it over into clinical practice is we have all these things that are risk factors for pain and for back pain. And they raise the risk. Do they always cause my patient's pain? And I think that's the challenging factor about the kind of biopsychosocial perspective of pain. So this is two multi-level, isn't it? It's kind of population level, and then it's also individual patient level. And
yes,
it's about understanding the research and what seems to put us at risk. We know that people with chronic lower back pain tend to have high levels of comorbidity, for example. So hypertension, hyperlipidemia, so raised cholesterol, osteoarthritis, all of these type of things are also involved. We have psychological risk factors, so anxiety,
depression,
job satisfaction. All of these things can raise our risk of lower back pain. But are they causative for the patient in front of me? And I find that's always the challenge that we have to work with, is kind of this population level, and then also boiling that down into what's contributing to my patient's problem. And it could be all of those things, or it could be none of those things, or those things could be present and maybe they're not involved as we would like, because it would make it far too easy. And I think this is what adds to the complexity of lower back pain. Again, this is where we have so much research. In fact, do we have too much research?
Absolutely. And what do you think about disc herniations causing chronic back pain?
Well, pain? You know, again, if you look at the risk factors for disc herniations, and again, risk factor doesn't mean causation. Mm-hmm. You know, we see things like high levels of adipose tissue, so body fat. So they've been quite, you know, generally associated. We see things like smoking is another big predictor, which is again, predictor is not explanatory. We see that being too active or being not active enough might contribute.
So we have to find a balance, right?
Of course, this is life, right? and then also another factor seems to also be our genetics. And what's the biggest factor that might drive disc herniation is age, because we know that disc degeneration is probably driven mostly by age. You know, so it's really complex. So the thing that we have to remember, I think, about disc herniation, and I think this is something that's important, is that how does it contribute to chronic pain? That's an interesting question. So I think we know how it might contribute to acute pain. So we might have a degenerative disc, herniates, it can compress, you know, the nerve root, it creates ischemia, creates hypoxia, maybe there's some inflammatory stuff that comes out, some macrophages, and they lead to some cytokine stuff going on, and it's all very complicated stuff, and that quite nicely explains the actual acute event. And that probably generally goes on for around 12 weeks as a minimum, right? And we know that leg pain is worse.
It's the inflammation. Yes. But then so they heal. They heal. They have a natural history, right?
Yeah, they do. And natural history is still quite variable because, again, prognosis is affected by prognostic factors. So, again, if we have something like a sequestered disc, which is where, you know, it kind of ruptures and the stuff comes out and spews all the, you know, crap everywhere. We know that they probably provoke a strong immune response.
Yes.
And that's what comes along and cleans it up. My analogy is always like Pac-Man. So it cleans it up and eats it away. But then the question is, how does that, if we have this immune response and we have this change or resorption of the material and we have some element of repairing the disc, not perfect, but it repairs a bit. Mm-hmm. then why do we get chronic pain? And that's the challenging question.
I just have a new client who started actually last week. She is 65. He had a lumbar fusion back in 2023 for her chronic back pain. And she did all sorts of things, didn't help her. And she just started clinical Pilates with me because even after the lumbar fusion, she's still in pain. So that's very interesting, you know.
Here we go. I'm going to say something controversial. I like this. I like to be a little controversial.
Yes.
Does back pain sometimes become chronic because it is mismanaged? So is it actually the mismanagement of the problem that causes the problem? We have a term for that, iatrogenic injury. And we know that too much imaging, too much medical intervention, too many surgeries tend to contribute to the development of chronic pain.
True.
So it's often the mismanagement that's the problem.
And also they are not educating the clients what can contribute to pain. When I was having chronic back pain for years, I was diagnosed with, you know, autoimmune condition, whatnot. So I was dealing with other medical, you know, health stuff as well. But no one ever told me that these things contribute to my back pain, you know, lack of sleep, being a little bit depressed because we lived on, you know, in another country and not my home country. Of course, I was missing my family and all, you know, the extra stress and everything was adding up. And my cup was overflowing, obviously. And I had back pain for years and no one ever told me, hey, this can contribute to that. And I had this degeneration and this herniation in my early 20s. But no one ever told me, hey, you know, this can contribute to that. So I didn't know what to address.
Yeah, it's, and again, that multidimensional model of pain is important. I think it's also challenging though. And I sometimes find it challenging because there have been instances where I've worked with people and we've cleared up sleep and then we've changed some other psychosocial factors. And sometimes the pain also doesn't change. So sometimes there is also that biological element that I think that for some people, unfortunately, I think back pain can be resistant to treatment. And I think that's why sometimes, you know, for some patients, another approach can be living well with some pain. And I think that's also important. And sometimes not focusing so much on pain can be really helpful for people that have a lot of pain. And that's not me saying that. That's the people that I've worked with kind of saying that. And, you know, that's strange.
Want to find a way to give back this holiday season, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good. Something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. 'Tis the season for giving back. And giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
From the horse's mouth, if you like.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And there is a belief that, for example, weak glutes cause back pain because the back takes over the glutes' job. Can one muscle truly compensate for another? And does this lead to pain? Please explain, because I had a post a couple of weeks ago on one of my social media profile, and then they attacked me that I'm talking about nonsense. You know, it can, weak glutes can cause back pain, or, you know, it can take over another muscle's job. So please explain, Ben. that
look,
you know.
Personally, I understand why people want these type of explanations because it makes life simple. Right. So rather than worrying about all of this biopsychosocial business, I can just activate my glutes and my back pain goes away. You know, why would we not want that? And then you've got people like me that come along and say, by the way, back pain's really complex. It's got all of these different factors. You might need to change this and change that. And so I get why people gravitate towards this. So, but just think about this. So we blame the QL, we blame the TVA, we blame the glutes, right? We blame all of these different muscles, and essentially they all have some kind of biomechanical effect. So they will change what we blame the hip flexor, right? So every muscle around that lumbopelvic area gets blamed. And it, you know, it's not stabilizing the spine. It's putting it in an anterior tilt. It's putting it in a posterior tilt. It's doing all of these different things, right? And essentially, it comes back to a biomechanical perspective of pain. Now, if there's one thing that we know about back pain, and one thing that we've learned from all of this research, the biomechanical contribution is not as big as we thought it was, right? Mm-hmm. How do we know that? Because we've tested people with anterior pelvic tilts. And so Lee Herrington did that study back in 2014. I think he found about 85% of people who didn't have pain had an anterior pelvic tilt, which might be tight hip flexors, weak glutes, and these type of things, right? So we know that when you look at these tests for things like anterior tilt, you can't really measure that because actually your skeleton is imbalanced in the sense that your knobbly bits, your ASIS, your PSIS, all these bony landmarks exist in different places for different people. We're not anatomical models. We're variable, organic, biological creatures that grow and adapt and evolve. So a lot of these kind of biomechanical theories, I think, really are simple, but incomplete, and probably a little bit wrong. Now, here's what muddies the waters and makes it a problem. Can you try to strengthen your glutes and help your back pain?
Absolutely not.
Well, I think actually, I'm going to disagree because I reckon there are a lot of people out there.
But the focus goes somewhere else. That's one thing, you know. I mean, your focus is on your glutes and not on your low back.
Yeah, it could be. But think about this. So I'm stretching my glutes, I'm loading my glutes, I'm moving, I'm exercising, and suddenly that area starts to feel a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And it might. So I think this is the problem. This, and we see this in posture research where people, does attempting to change your posture help pain? Yes. Does it change posture? Well, no one knows because they never measure it. So it might be the process of movement and exercise.
Exactly. Movement.
So this is,
yes.
Yeah, this is the point, is that when I move my glutes and I extend my hip and flex my hip and do these things, am I also getting movement in the lumbar spine?
Absolutely. Yeah. You move everything, right?
That's the key. So,
yeah, so movement.
All of
it's not the
things,
posture. As
no
we,
one measures that.
As we hear from Adam Meekins, that your best posture is your next posture, right?
I hear it's too much from Adam Meekins.
next posture is your best posture, right? Because but you just need to move.
All of these things, all of these exercises that we do, that we label being special, activating the core, activating the glutes, they all share one thing, which is the process of moving. Mm-hmm. So does moving help? Well, for some people, yes. There are other people where they've done lots of movement and it hasn't helped because maybe that wasn't the problem. Maybe there's another problem. Maybe it's autoimmune. Maybe it's psychosocial. Maybe it's another variable. Again, we have all of these different variables, right? That's the blessing and the curse of the contributors to back pain.
Yes.
But I think so many people in an attempt to strengthen their glutes fix their posture have helped their back pain. And that has therefore validated their theory. It's called post hoc reasoning. So what I've done is I've validated my theory by the end result, not by the actual mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads to the theory gets stronger and bigger because look, it works. Oh my God. It's amazing. It worked. It worked for me. It works for my patients. And I'm sure it does. It doesn't mean the reason that it worked is correct.
Yes. So movement, it comes down that we have blood flow going, you know, we just move the body and maybe that's what you needed. But again, everyone is different. Maybe that solves the problem for someone, but Absolutely. Doesn't solve for, if you live a sedentary lifestyle and you never moved and you have chronic back pain, of course, movement will help you, right? I mean, probably, possibly, we don't know 100%, but.
So can we say it will help? Will it fix the problem? That's another level. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Yes.
So does movement probably help the majority of people?
Help.
Absolutely. Does it solve back pain? Then that's where we get into sticky ground.
Yes, yes. Fix. I like the word fix back pain.
Yeah,
it would be nice to fix.
That's what we tend to see. What do we know about back pain? It's a recurrent condition. So for 70% of people, it will recur within 1 year. And I think for about 30% of people, it will recur a fair bit more than that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when you get back pain and you do a few movements and some stretches, is your back pain likely to get better? Of course, because back pain gets better. Unfortunately, it also gets worse. So back pain makes treatments look good.
Mm-hmm.
It makes everything look good until it comes back.
Exactly. You touched on something that I actually wanted to ask you, stretching, because we know stretching can help back pain, but in short term, right?
Well, what is stretching? It's low-dose movement,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
if you compare stretching to mobilizing to, I don't know, some other yoga and Pilates,
yeah,
I would imagine they'd all come out a bit similar. Because all
Pilates is a little bit different because we are not just stretching, we are also strengthening.
Yeah, but I would say still the key there would be the movement part.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And it's moving between different positions and a bit of variety and that's all brilliant. But I can imagine that between lots of different things, again, we wouldn't see a big difference because that it's that basic level of low dose movement that might be really powerful for a mm-hmm. lot of people.
Is it because of pain gating?
So I don't. No, the pain gate theory, again, that's been out, you know, this is Melzack and Wall back in the 60s. And it kind of this large fiber inhibits this small fiber and those kind of things. And it's a bit of a basic perspective of that. I would say we probably get some descending modulatory stuff going on. So not so much the gating of the signal, maybe some other anti-nociceptive stuff that might be going on. So it might not be, you know, the classic pain gates, the rubbing your arm. And it might be a little bit more complex than that in that we have some opioid mechanisms, serotonin, cannabinoids, and they are going to kind of descend. We have the rostral ventromedial medulla on cells, off cells. It's all very complicated stuff. But I would tend to think pain gate, maybe, but I would also tend to think a lot of these things might activate some kind of modulatory stuff that's a little bit different. But for some people, actually, those modulatory systems don't inhibit pain. They actually increase pain. And that's one of the problems that we see, that people have not inhibitory systems, they have facilitatory systems whereby they actually amp up some of the signals that occur. So, you know, this is one of the big problems with pain, and especially chronic pain, is that treatments are not consistent, because actually the response to treatment is quite individual from people. You know, it's, the magic isn't in the treatment, it's in the person.
Exactly. The reason I asked also, because I was foam rolling my back for years for my back pain. It worked for a short period of time, but it never really helped me. Until, you know, like graded exercise, strengthening, you know, my whole body and not just my back, you know, everything. So foam rolling stretching was helping me for, before we went out, I knew we were going to be out for 6 hours, you know, during the day, walking, this and that. Yeah. Stretching before and after helped me, but, you know, only for a couple of hours.
Yeah. So foam rolling probably works slightly differently. It's something called diffuse noxious inhibitory control, which is actually where pain inhibits pain. So what you get is, because you have a noxious stimulus, because foam rolling is uncomfortable, right?
Yes, especially in the beginning when you're getting used to the pain, right?
Yeah, and exactly. So actually, the salience of this stimulus becomes a lot more, you know, my brain takes notice a lot more of the new stimulus than the old stimulus. But what it needs to be is painful. So if foam rolling wasn't uncomfortable, it probably wouldn't generate the effects that it does. So it's actually the discomfort that it creates. Again, though, the reason that the problem is that relief is transient is because of the, when you activate the diffuse noxious inhibitory system, which again is a descending modulatory system, when you kind of activate that system, it doesn't fix the problem. It just provides another chemical response. And over time, that chemical response diminishes as the stimulus reduces. Mm-hmm. So these are transient things.
So that what happens, I just get used to the foam roller, the pain of the foam roller, and it won't help me anymore. That's kind of like, you know, my...
And I think people then go onto the handle of a kettlebell, don't they? Or something harder and something stronger. And when they get massaged,
I went to a lacrosse ball. I had to do a lacrosse ball.
Exactly.
Yes. That explains it. Thanks.
And we see that with painful massage as well, that people don't like massage unless it's really deep. Mm-hmm. And they think that's like doing some kind of thing to the fascia or realigning something.
That was me.
Oh, there you go. I'm sorry. But it's fine. The other side, right?
Yeah.
But this is why pain mechanisms are quite important to understand. But actually now I understand, why do people want it hard and deep? And massage.
Yes, that's what we meant, right? Yes, exactly.
There we go. See, we didn't think it was going to take that turn.
No. But it only took us 29 minutes to get here, Ben.
And that's actually a record of time for me to get there. Not quickly. That was the longest it's taken.
Not quickly, Ben.
Yes, not quickly. So it's that people need continually greater stimulus. Mm-hmm. They want deeper massage. They want harder objects. Right? Mm-hmm. Because that is what's going to create the stimulus required for the inhibitory mechanism. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I understand now. Thank you for explaining that.
That
makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. It's the body. The body's amazing. Mechanistically, it's an amazing thing.
Exactly. Now, what are some of the most common myths about back pain that you face in your practice? You know, like, what is it?
Well, I think one of the big ones that I don't know if it's a myth, but I think people want to know, what is that kind of best exercise that they need to do?
Yes. Tell me.
Well, yes, that would be brilliant. I'll tell you off air, but it's going to cost you.
Okay. The best, please.
Yes, I need a new Range Rover. So not that I have a Range Rover to start, but look, I think that's the big one, is that we have this idea that there's some kind of, you know, definitive exercise or answer that helps everybody. You know, if you do this exercise, it gets rid of back pain. And again, this is the problem. This is the misinformation part of back pain, right? Is that we've got to this point whereby we have everyone on Instagram, on YouTube, mm-hmm. selling us this idea of an answer, mm-hmm. right? So back pain is almost like an industry for views and likes and clicks and, you know, because it's so prevalent and so many people have this problem. So I think it's that idea that there's going to be this kind of, this is the thing to do. And actually, quite a few of my sessions that I have with people are going over, you know, people say to me, oh, I heard this is good, Ben. What do you think? Or, you know, I saw this guy and he said, you should do this. Mm-hmm. You know, should I
like it when they say should.
Yeah.
You know, you just...
and I think a lot of what I do actually with people is say, well, you could do that, but there might be another alternative, or you might have tried it and it didn't help, right? So I understand that people, if there's a magical answer out there, why would you not want that answer? So I get why people want it. So I don't blame people for wanting a magic answer. You know, absolutely. I get it. I understand it. I want one. And remember as well, therapists are looking for a magical answer as well. Mm-hmm. That's why they go on courses and they learn methods and they listen to idiots like me, you know, because they're trying, you know, because they want to do better and they want to learn and they want to help people. But unfortunately, this is what we learn from things like research, is that lots of things might help. And absolutely. When you only have one way of helping people and it doesn't help, well, you're kind of screwed. So again, it's about having, I think, a little bit more of a adaptable, flexible approach to working with people and helping people.
So it's kind of like treating back pain like a multi-modal approach would be working, you know?
Yeah, you come to see me, right? And we are going to talk, you know, we're going to think about, we have all of these risk factors and we have all of these elements that we know can be associated with pain. Unfortunately, they're all a little bit bi-directional, meaning if you have lots of pain, are you less likely to sleep well? If you have lots of pain, are you less likely to be active? So we also have to have an awareness of that as well, that it's not unidirectional, it's likely bi-directional. So you're going to come to see me and I'm going to think about, you know, what have you been told by all of these different people you'll have been to see, and we'll make some sense of that. But then also, what are some of these other factors maybe that we could attempt to change? But also in the awareness of, this isn't a certainty. Again, it's a little bit of a game of trial and error. So I think we have to be careful with a lot of these multimodal factors in that we treat them and approach them cautiously. And do we turn sleep into the hip flexor? Oh my God, you're not sleeping well, so that must be the cause of your pain, right? And So I wrote a paper many years ago, or maybe 3 or 4 years ago, very well cited, been a really popular paper. And I talked about turning the biopsychosocial model into the biomedical model. And sometimes we do that. We've taken all of this biopsychosocial stuff and we've become a little bit too certain and we've become a little bit too medical with it. So we have to be a little bit cautious in saying these things could be associated. Let's attempt to see how they can be changed, but also be cautious in that we're not providing the same posture, muscle, certainty of the past.
Perfect posture, right?
Absolutely. But again, you could sleep perfectly and still have pain.
Yeah, that's true.
And you could sleep dreadfully and have no pain.
Yeah.
And I think one thing I will say is that I do think human dysregulation manifests itself in a few ways. So I think for some patients, they get pain. Others may get anxiety. Other people may develop chronic health problems. Right. So dysregulation of human function is important, but it doesn't mean it's going to manifest itself in a linear, simple way. It can change, it can adapt. You know, a lot of the genesis of pain or the risks of pain are also risks of health, risks of mental health, risks of early mortality.
Why do you think that these misconceptions persist despite advancements in research and, you know, evidence?
Because the problem with evidence is it hasn't provided an answer. It's provided information, right? So as I said, we have lots and lots of information about back pain. We have more information about back pain than anything else, probably apart from cancer. Has it improved how we treat back pain? Has back pain reduced in its prevalence?
Probably not.
No. So
we probably have more.
Yes, there we go. So I think that's our problem, is that we have all this research, But at the same point, we haven't got improvements always in the way that we treat it.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be that lower back pain isn't treatable in the sense that, is pain normal? Yes.
It is, yeah.
Is pain likely to happen to your back at some time in your lifetime? Yes. But it might be where the problem lies is this element of really persistent, chronic, longer-term back pain, I think. But I also, as I said before, I sometimes think we turn non-dangerous or ordinary back pain into something worse by the fact that we say, oh, we need an operation or we need an injection.
Because I also believe that people think that if they are in pain, there is also tissue damage and they are causing more pain. They should not move because they get scared because of the pain. We all experience pain differently, right? Your pain level is different than my pain level.
Is pain-related worry normal? I think it is. I think it is normal. Can be exaggerated, you know, and I don't think people are exaggerating. I think the response is probably a little exaggerated, and I think that's important. But pain-related worry is probably normal. But like all things, some people worry more than other people, right? And I think that the biggest question that I ever get from patients is, will I make it worse if I keep moving? Will I make it worse if I go swimming? Will I make it worse if I go to my sister's wedding? Right. And I think that's really normal. But I do think we have this idea that, you know, pain is quite linked to the state of tissue. Right.
Yes. And
one of the things I think we've learned from the world of pain science is it can be linked to the state of the tissue, but often it is not. So I have a little saying when I teach. I say back pain is rarely medically serious, but it is seriously painful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that.
Damage to discs is really low, maybe 3%, 5% of the prevalence of back pain. Yeah. Radicular nerve problems, probably around 10%. You know, really serious stuff, probably about 1%, dependent on, you know, where you practice, if you're in accident, an emergency or whatever. So even we could say 90% of back pain is probably not medically serious. But it still is really, really painful. And I think that can be hard to digest, that something can be really, really painful, but isn't very serious.
Serious, yes. Yeah.
This must be a serious problem. It hurts.
Yeah. And how do you think these misconceptions or beliefs impact the way people manage their back pain? You know, like...
Well, I think if we're really fearful, I think that affects us psychologically. You know, and I don't know how many people are truly fearful. I think we throw that term around a bit too much. I think people have reduced confidence. I think they have some worry. But if you're worried about your back or you're worried about the future or whatever, it probably has an effect on our behaviours. So do we move less? Do we do less things that are positive for us? Do we engage in less social activity? Do we do less sport? Are we a little bit more cautious and apprehensive? So I think we have to separate the idea that belief significantly affects pain. I don't think it does simply, because I don't think we have good data that, you know, what we believe directly affects nociception, for example. But I do think it affects our behaviours. And if it affects our behaviours, I think it has an effect on us in general and our physiology and, you know, health and these type of things. So I think negative beliefs often lead to behaviours that aren't always positive. And I think over time, they have an effect on people.
Yeah, I agree with that, actually. Yes. I wanted to ask this specifically because one of my friends reached out to me yesterday. She went to a chiropractor couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
And she went there because of her shoulder pain anyway. And the chiropractor told her that her shoulder pain is linked to her low back, because apparently her low back is weak, and the way they tested her low back is with a machine that tests muscle weakness. So what does evidence say about these connections, and how should people interpret these kinds of assessments? Because now she's saying that, you know, like, I believe that, you know, everything is connected with the body, and she understands now, of course, the shoulder pain can be linked to weak, you know, low back. Can you please?
Well, I don't even know if shoulder pain is linked to weak shoulders, let alone, and I don't even know that back pain is linked to a weak back, let alone a weak back linked to a weak shoulder.
Yes.
Is it common to have pain in two sides of your body?
Yes, absolutely.
We see conditions like fibromyalgia, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? I very much doubt these are biomechanically driven. I think they would tend to be systemically driven. So are they autoimmune? Are they, you know, something else that's going on? Mm-hmm. So multi-site pain is actually a negative prognostic factor. So we know that the more sites of pain, often the longer the problem tends to go on for. So a multi-site pain is important. However, multi-site pain probably doesn't indicates something systemic rather than indicating something biomechanical. And I suppose the only machine I can think of that would test your strength would be a dynamometer, which is a measurement of ability for you to produce force. You know, so, but I bet you it wasn't a dynamometer. I bet you it was some weird machine that does some kind of stuff that no one knows.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. Like, there's those ones that tell us of, you know, there's some real crap out there. So I think that people are often trying to find these biomechanical rationales. This is weak. So I always ask this question, why would weakness cause pain?
Yeah.
And people will say, well, it changes joint alignment, or it changes.
And my other question would be, weak for what? Weak to do what? You know, like, for what? You know, lifting 200 pounds. Yeah, you're probably weak for that. But to lift, you know, the something, you know, like a 10 pound weight, you're probably not that weak. So it depends, you know.
And why would, if you can pick something up and it hurts, weakness isn't the problem, because you've picked it up.
Exactly. There you go.
If you were too weak, you wouldn't be able to pick it up. Pain wouldn't even figure in. You wouldn't be strong enough to go through the action. So what someone actually means is you're actually not tolerant of the activity, which may not be weakness. Tolerance and weakness are not synonymous. They're not the same thing.
And actually, I wanted to touch base on that when we were discussing the best exercise for back pain. There is no such thing as best exercise, but what I do believe in, any exercise within pain tolerance is good. That's probably the best for you, right? Because you are, you know, doing that. Correct me if I'm wrong. The best exercise is the one that you can do within your pain tolerance, or yes. And also, you can actually do it consistently because you can stick to it long term, right?
The best exercise is the one you are doing.
Exactly. That's it.
Yeah, because we all have what's the best. You know, we have this idea of what's the best, etc. But if it's not sustainable and it doesn't fit into our behaviors. So here's the big problem. Exercise is a behavior. And the biggest problem that people have is they struggle to change their behavior. And we know that. How many people don't get enough exercise, etc.? It's not just a pain problem. It's a death problem. It's an everything problem. It's, you know, across the board, we know this. But we need to see exercise as something that should be sustainable and achievable. And the problem is we're looking for the best. The best one is the most sustainable one.
Exactly.
And that could be anything, couldn't it? That could be whatever is sustainable for that person.
Yeah, whatever they can do most days of the week, or at least 2 to 3 times a week.
And that's why walking is fantastic. That's why we are seeing things like paddle and these kind of things that people can do when they're older, you know, that are social. For me, the best type of exercise is social. It gives us joy. It gives us connection. It's something that we look forward to doing, you know. And for me, that's the power, you know.
I absolutely agree with that. This is why I actually came up with my clinical Pilates online program for moms with back pain, because moms usually, you know, they don't have time.
Yeah.
You know, they have to take care of the kids. So it's only 30 minutes, 3-4 times a week, and they can do it through Zoom.
Lower the barriers.
Exactly.
The barriers.
They don't have to worry about parking. It's simple. We do push-ups, squats, pistol squats.
Achievable, we do. I think.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Now, can you share an example of a patient whose understanding of their back pain changed dramatically?
I think most, I would like to say that most of my patients change an element of their understanding of their painful problem. I'm actually thinking of a patient that I saw last night, actually, at the moment, because a lot of the discussion that we had was around the cognitive part. But one thing that I actually find fascinating, and we talked about 4 o'clock, about this time yesterday, he was in Germany. And I think what's fascinating sometimes is that even though people can change their cognitions, there's still this nagging doubt in the back of their mind. Even though he said to me yesterday, he said, I know that hurt doesn't equal harm, but there's still a little demon in my brain that says, but what if?
Yeah.
And that for me was really enlightening. You know, that for me was interesting. Even though over time we've got to a place where he says, I know hurt doesn't equal harm, he still, that is still a difficult concept sometimes for him.
What do you think it helped him to get here, you know, to get that thinking now?
Well, because I think when you've had back pain for a while, and he was a dancer, very active, etc. And, you know, I hope he doesn't mind me, you know, I'm not naming any names. But I think experience helps of having some painful problems, having flare-ups, realizing, you know, reading a bit about pain, talking to people like me. And again, I think one of the most important things for people changing their perspectives is it doesn't just come from me. I'll point them into some resources, some other things to read. It's not just Ben talking crap again. It's other people saying similar things and having similar perspectives. And also highlighting for people where that might be true for them. What is it in their story that proves that to be true, where hurt doesn't actually equal harm, where it was painful, but they got through it and nothing worse happened?
Like a massage, a painful massage?
I don't know so much a painful massage, but maybe going to the gym. So it hurt and we went to the gym. I will often say to people, if it's excruciating pain, that's probably telling you to not go to the gym.
Yes.
But if it's irritating you, if it's annoying you, then maybe you could give it a try, see how you get on. And they'll often say, it hurt a little bit. I woke up today and I was fine. It didn't get any worse.
Do you have patients like, you know, they start out, they are with you for a couple of weeks and they have a setback? You know, like...
Welcome to the story of my life.
Now, what advice do you give to those patients or to those people who start at something for their chronic back pain? They had it for 10 years. And after 2, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, they have a little setback. Should they give up?
No. Well, I frame it as a learning experience. So, You know, if you've had back pain for 10 years, is it likely to be that you are going to have to manage your back a little bit? Right. Is it, are you going to come to see Ben and suddenly all your painful problems are going to go away forever? If we would not be having this conversation if that was true. I'd be on a beach. I'd be surrounded by beautiful women, cocktails. You know, I know I'm surrounded by beautiful women.
Thanks,
right,
Ben.
Now.
Thanks.
There we go. There we go. But I'd be on a beach. I'd be, someone would be fanning me with palm leaves. It'd be amazing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So these problems come back. All painful
now wake
problems.
Up. Wake up, Ben. Okay, wake up.
Yes. Sorry. I was thinking about what could be if I sold some of that back bullshit. So, look. I think the point is that we always have to be realistic and say pain is, you're going to experience pain again because you're a human. You've had it for 10 years. The probability is you're going to have it again at some point. And I think it can be a learning experience about how far we can push ourselves right now. Some of the things that maybe we can avoid, some of the things we don't need to avoid. Maybe we've done too much. Maybe it's a bit of a dosing error, right? So my analogy is like sunburn. Sometimes, you know, sun tanning, no one gives up sun tanning. We just lower the dosage, right?
That's it.
Yeah, exactly. So my analogy is that we learn maybe where we've done a bit too much. Our body hasn't reacted in the best way. Let's just manage it a bit better. Mm-hmm. So it's a learning experience and hopefully mm-hmm. one that helps us in the future.
Mm-hmm. So you had that experience.
Professionally or personally?
Both.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Professionally, I would say 90% of the people that I will see will have some mm-hmm. element of. And what's interesting is I will often get an email. So let's say I saw someone 3 or 4 months ago and then email me and say, Ben, can we book in a session? My back's flared up a little bit. I just need someone to help me manage it. And mm-hmm. that will be exactly what we do. In fact, that's probably how I see most of my patients is I will tend to see them when they require that support.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that would just be a normal part of the process. And then after time, it might be people say, well, I don't need Ben anymore. I can do this myself. I'm bored of Ben. Mm-hmm. He just says the same crap all the time. I can do this on my own, which is brilliant. I'm fine with that. Mm-hmm. But it's a process.
Mm-hmm. So flare-ups, when you are treating your back pain with movement, is absolutely natural. Or, you know, if you work out and you've been having back pain, having setbacks is a normal part of the process, right?
When you are in pain, you have a sensitized system. And we give mechanical stimulus like movement and exercise. And sometimes we get the dosing a bit wrong, the stimulus is a bit too much, and we provoke the sensitized system. It doesn't mean things have got worse. It doesn't mean you've damaged the system. You just have more pain. And sometimes mm-hmm. they need a rational voice just to say, it's okay, it's normal. How can we manage this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, what advice would you give to someone struggling with back pain but overwhelmed by conflicting information online, you know?
Oh, Jesus, again. I mean... welcome to my world. We're just talking about my everyday existence. So again, this is more difficult, actually. I find
they are scrolling through. Yeah. So give advice to someone who's scrolling through social media and they say, oh, here is the best exercise to fix your back pain. Or here is the best supplement to fix your back pain. Actually, I was scrolling today in the morning and the best supplement to fix back pain. So what advice would you give to someone, you know, like that?
What was the supplement, by the way?
I'm going to send it to you. I can't remember the name, but okay, I'm going to send you in private.
Right. Just double checking. I just know I'm my back a little sore. So, and I don't want to have to do anything. I'm just going to, but you know too. Why people want a supplement? Because it's easy.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's not judgmental saying that.
No.
Why would you not want something easy? Jesus.
Exactly. But they get, I think after a while, because they've seen so many things online, they tried so many things, then they get not mad, but disappointed after a while, and they just give up.
I would tend to say, you know, probably better to get information from people that you trust or are trustworthy. Now, lots of people I probably come across as trustworthy. I'm not. No, I'm joking. I try to be. But I think most people that are trustworthy will not be so definitive. Mm-hmm. If someone is really definitive for me,
like stop doing this and do this.
Exactly. You need to stop this, do this, take this, buy this. Wait, and then you've got idiots like me saying, oh, I don't know.
this can help, but we are not sure this may or may not help.
And which one are you going to go for?
Well, yes, I know. Who I would pick, someone like you. That's why I would pick Ben. Yes, absolutely.
Of course. But that's different. So, I can understand why this, you'd say, oh, God, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Oh, Jesus, he's not very certain. Whereas actually the best doctors, I think, and the best clinicians are people that probably will say, could help. Well, mm-hmm. Let's try it. Let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll have to adjust. Maybe we'll have to adapt. Look, how many blood pressure medications are there out there?
I don't know.
Loads. So you have calcium blockers, beta block, all of these different types, right? And they're developed because people respond in different ways. Mm-hmm. And so a doctor will say, let's try this blood pressure medication. If it doesn't work, let's give another one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't see there's any difference in that, right? And I think that's probably, we'd accept that actually quite a lot of the time, wouldn't we? You see that in
Oncology,
you see it in autoimmune issues where people will say, let's try this. Even antibiotics, maybe you need a bigger dose, maybe you need a longer course of antibiotics, maybe you need to try a different one. So I think we need to normalize a little bit more of that perspective whereby, we're going to say, yeah, it could help. Let's given your story. So the one thing that I will say, anyone who says anything will work for everybody is an idiot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they are not trustworthy. So that's a big red flag for someone. They don't know much about, the contributing back factors of back pain and they just really want to fix their back pain. Someone who tells you that this should work and this one thing will fix your back pain, that they actually not trustworthy, right?
Yeah. One of the big problems, though, is also things like medical literacy. And a knowledge, we can be really smart in one area and actually not so smart. In fact, sometimes when you're super smart at one thing, you overestimate your smartness at other things. And welcome to my world. I think I'm smart at everything. I'm not. So the smartest thing is to realize you're not that smart sometimes. But I would definitely say that people who are a little cautious or maybe a bit more understanding of the vagaries and the nuances, that's important.
Mm-hmm. And how important is education in helping people to take control over their back pain?
So look, if we understand...
Too much.
How much is too much? So that's another question.
Yes. Okay. So let's answer the first one.
Let's do the first one. Let's not get greedy. So we'll go with... education, again, I think information affects behaviors. So if you better understand the problem, like hurt doesn't equal harm, maybe that will affect your positive movement behaviors. If you misunderstand the problem, that might have an effect on your behaviors, right? Mm-hmm. So I think if you see back pain as painful but not dangerous, again, that might encourage you to have more positive behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's very important to understand that belief affects behavior. And I'm looking at every encounter to positively shape people's behaviors through their beliefs. Now, the other question is, how much is too much?
How much is too much?
So this is a bit like hair gel.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So a little bit of information is like a little bit of hair gel. It can look great. too much information can be like too much hair gel. It gets messy mm-hmm. quickly.
mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. So that I nicked that from someone regarding philosophy, and they said philosophy is like hair gel, and it was exactly the same thing. So my friend Jason Silvernail. So I think we can overwhelm people. Mm-hmm. It's very easy. So you're in pain. You've got a back pain and you come to see me and Ben tells me the history of pain. Right. How much of that are you going to process?
Not that much.
How much do you really care?
I only care about what is going to fix my back.
Ah, so my analogy is the same as a mechanic. You go to the mechanic. What do you want the mechanic to do? You want him to fix your car.
Yeah.
So do you want a lecture about the engine?
Absolutely not.
There you go.
Come on. I'm a woman, Ben.
Oh, God. I don't want to do stereotypes. Let's not get into stereotypes.
Just fix it and I'll go.
I know. What are men good for? Fixing the car.
Yep.
So, look. I think that's the issue is that, so can good information affect behavior? Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yes.
Does a lecture about pain or about pathology or about anything, mm-hmm. you know, who is that really for? So again, mm-hmm. I'm going to say often. So here's the key, actually. I would probably say to you, what do you really want to know? What are you worried about? What are you concerned mm-hmm. about? And mm-hmm, that way, mm-hmm. I can actually give you information you need.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So if they tell you, am I damaging anything with this excruciating pain? Or, you know, and they can, then you can tell them that it not necessarily, you know.
I will say pain is rarely medically serious, but it's often exactly. seriously painful.
Exactly. Okay.
Do you see?
Got it.
So
yes.
I think the key to great education is finding out what people want to know. Mm-hmm. And most mm-hmm. often it is, will I make it worse if I do a certain thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, got it. Not too much hair gel, right?
Not too much. Look, I mean, obviously, you know, I've still got quite, yes, yeah, I'm yeah. 46, I've still got quite a good head of hair, but I keep it low maintenance.
Yep.
Perfect. No hair gel for me.
Perfect, Ben. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this conversation. Thank you so much for joining the show today. And thank you for the listeners tuning in to today's episode of the Back to Movement podcast. And that's all for today. And see you next time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you.